Thank you for the warm welcome here. And it's very nice to
be very nice to spend another evening with you before tomorrow when we head off to Copenhagen.
So tonight we're going to talk about don't believe everything you think, which is something that I learned by trial and error in my Buddhist practice. I really shouldn't believe everything I think. And it became the title of a book here. So I'll talk about the topic and then tell you a little bit about the book too. But first of all, let's start with a little bit of meditation so we can get a shift. Okay? So sit up straight, your feet flat on the floor if you're sitting on a chair. Your hands in your lap, right on the left, thumbs touching. And begin by doing a brief body scan, checking in with your body to see if there is tension anywhere, your shoulders or your stomach or your jaw, anywhere in your body. And if there is, then just release it, let it go. Then bring your attention to your breath, letting your breath flow naturally. And place your attention either at the tip, the upper lip in your nostrils so you can feel the sensation of the air as it passes there. Or put your attention at your belly, your abdomen, and observe how it rises and falls as you inhale and exhale. So put your attention at one of those two places. Don't go back and forth between them. But simply watch your breath and experience your breath and be interested in what's going on as you breathe. If you get distracted by a sound or a thought or a physical sensation, just notice that, but bring your focus again back home to the breath. So as much as your mind strays, that much you bring it home to the breath. And by keeping it on one object, in this case the breath, then the mind settles down. So we'll have a few minutes of silence to do this. let's cultivate our motivation and think about our long-term happiness instead of our short-term pleasure, and have a determination to live an ethical life, to abandon harming others and to do what we can to benefit them, so that we can live peacefully with others in this lifetime, and also create the causes to be able to meet the Dharma in the future. And let's also have a kind heart towards others, realizing that everything we have and everything we know has come to us due to their efforts. And so with a wish to repay the kindness of others, let's generate the bodhicitta, the aspiration for full awakening, so that while we're on the path and after we've attained full awakening, we'll be able to develop progressively more skills to be of greater and greater benefit to all these living beings who have been kind to us in so many ways. So to learn how to follow that path to full Buddhahood, we need to listen to explanations of the Dharma, and that's why we're here this evening. But our long-term goal is to be able to have the qualities enabling us to be of the greatest benefit to other living beings. So let's make that our motivation for being here. So, this book, Don't Believe Everything You Think, is based on a poem written by a Tibetan several centuries ago. His name was Tobme Zampo. And the poem is called 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas. Some of you may have heard of it before. It's a very popular text in the Tibetan tradition, in all the different Tibetan schools. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama often teaches this text before giving initiations. And what's so wonderful about this text is in 37 verses, he talks about, he gives us some really, really wise advice. And he talks about situations that we encounter in our life that often cause us a lot of angst, and he proposes solutions to those situations. Now, of course, the solutions he proposes are the last thing in the world we want to do when we're in that situation. Okay? Because when we're in difficult situations, what usually happens is we resort to our old habitual emotional patterns. Some of these may have been developed when we were children and they served us when we were children. Some of them may have been developed in previous lives and we've carried them with from previous lives. But in any case, they are not well thought out strategies for solving situations. Their knee-jerk emotional responses. And as such, they often get us into trouble. Do you know that from your own experience? I do. Yeah. We kind of run on automatic,
and just go through our life, you know, following every urge that comes in the mind, and whatever thought comes in the mind, we just go along with it. You know, what is it called? Going with the flow. Remember? Yeah, that was my generation that came up with it. Except we go with the flow of ignorance, not wisdom, not compassion. Plain old ignorance and self-centeredness. And so we get ourselves in a lot of jams. And some of these jams you may have noticed in your life are habitual, they're recurring. Have you noticed that? You play out the same thing, but with different people, again and again and again. And you wonder why you keep meeting all these obnoxious people who keep doing the same thing to you. Yeah. Because, of course, I mean, we already know, I told you last night, we're totally innocent of everything, good-hearted and benevolent, and we live in a world full of jerks, who, unfortunately, are not at this talk. It would be really good if they came, wouldn't it? Yeah? I mean, I always get at the talks the people who are not jerks. You know, it's the people who are jerks who need to come to the talk. But it's all the kind, benevolent people who are right, just like me. You know, those are the ones that come to the talks. Yeah. I have a friend who does conflict resolution. And he, you know, he says the same things. That it's always the nice cooperative people that come to his workshops on conflict resolution, not the other side of the conflict who are obstinate and disagreeable. So it happens, you know, in both situations. Anyway, you know, so Tobe Sambo gives us this advice, and like I said, it's the opposite of what we want to do. But if we try it, you know, because the advice is advice about how to think. It's not advice about what to do. It's how to think. And if we try to follow this advice and change our thought pattern, then we will know what to do in the situation. So often people come to me and they come and it's like, oh, this thing happened, this is, I'm in crisis. And he did this and she did that, and what do I do? You know, the first thing is, what do I do? And I always say, don't do anything right now. Yeah? First of all, you have to get your mind calm. You have to find a way to look at the situation in a more balanced way, a more realistic and beneficial way. When you do that, then what to do will be easy. But if we jump right away to what to do, usually what's going on is we're upset and we want the other person to change and we want to do something that will make them change. Isn't that usually it? Because we usually think that the problem comes from them. Yeah, the problem comes from outside. Like I told you, all these obnoxious people, you know. So if we could do something to make them just close their mouth, you know, or make them be more cooperative, or make them apologize, wow. Wouldn't that be nice if for once they apologized? Yeah? Then we would be happy. Yeah, but the thing isn't what to do. It's how to change our mind, because when we're in a very reactive emotional state, yeah, I'm going to tell you something you're not going to like, we're not perceiving things accurately. And you're going to go, what? I am perceiving things accurately, you know? Yeah. So, for example, yeah, if I'm going to give you a definition of anger. Yeah. Anger is a mind that is based on exaggerating negative qualities or projecting negative qualities that aren't there. And then because of that, wanting to fight and destroy what's causing us the harm, or flight, get away from it. Okay? Sounds okay as a definition from anger, right? Now, when you're angry, do you think that you're exaggerating a negative quality or projecting one that isn't there? No. I'm angry, but I'm not exaggerating or projecting. I am seeing reality. Isn't that interesting? Yeah? The definition of anger tells us we're exaggerating and projecting. And we are so ignorant, excuse my words, at that time, that we think we aren't exaggerating and projecting because we think the problem is that person. The problem is outside. And the solution is very simple. Now, because I'm right, they're wrong, and the solution is they change. That's it. Very clear. Doesn't need a lot of discussion. Yeah, they just need to change and stop doing what they're doing. That's it. Of course, they tell me the same thing, which just, again, shows how stupid they are. Yeah. Because I am seeing it correctly and giving them my sages advice about what to do that they do not want to listen to. These sentient beings. Okay? So that's why the book is entitled Don't Believe Everything You Think. Because here, you know, right in that example of anger, we're believing what we're thinking. But what we're thinking is wrong because it's based on exaggeration and projection. So we shouldn't believe what we're thinking. Yeah? We need to step back and find another way to look at the situation. And when we do that, then the reactive emotion decreases. We don't have to suppress it. We shouldn't suppress it. It just goes away by itself. So remember yesterday I was telling you this one thing about when somebody was criticizing me and I gave all the pain to my self-centered thought? Remember? You know, the self-centered thought isn't me, it's over here. Somebody's criticizing me, I take it all, the criticism and my pain, and I give it all to the self-centered thought. Then I'm free of pain, nobody's criticizing me. My self-centered thought, which is my real enemy, because it's the one that destroys my happiness by making me so obsessed with myself, then that real enemy gets all the pain. So, yeah, it's great, isn't it? Yeah, it's not me. I'm giving it to the self-centered thought. Okay? So that is looking at the situation in a different way. And when you do that, then, you know, you're no longer upset. Okay? The external situation has not changed. What has changed is how we think about it. Okay? And so, in order to change what we think, first we have to doubt what we're thinking. Doubt the validity of what we're thinking. Okay? Which again, usually we don't do. I'm not talking about self-doubt here. I'm not talking about a lack of self-confidence and self-doubt. I'm talking about an idea comes in our mind and just stopping and asking ourselves, is that really an accurate description of what is happening? So I remember with one of my friends, she told me the story of her son was getting married and her daughter-in-law's, you know, her future The parents of her future daughter-in-law were throwing a party for like an engagement party or something. And she went. She didn't know any of the people there except her son and his fiancée. And his fiancée was, the way she described the situation to me is she walked in the door and the fiancée completely ignored her. Yeah. And she was going, wow, I'm the mother of her future husband and she's ignoring me and she knows I don't know anybody at this place because they're all her family and she just keeps on talking to whoever she's talking to, having a good chat, and I'm just standing there not knowing what to do. And she's getting really upset about this. So we did a little exercise where we said, okay, let's take out all the words that involve emotion or judgment, and let's simply describe the facts of the situation, what actually happened. And what she came out with was, I opened the door, walked in the room, and my future daughter-in-law was talking to someone. That was it. Everything else was her interpretation, embellishment, projection of motivations onto another person. And so all of her unhappiness was self-created. Okay? So that's what I mean about not believing everything we think, because when we make up a big story, yeah, I mean, we're just doing our creative writing class with the star being me and creating a drama all about ourselves. Yeah? Whereas often the actual situation is quite simple and there's nothing really that big going on. Okay? Another example. This was about, I would say, 18 years ago, because, no, must be 20 years ago, because my friend, this is another friend, was pregnant. Her daughter's now about 19, so it must have been 20 years ago. She was pregnant. When you're pregnant, you're supposed to put on weight, right? That's healthy when you're pregnant. So I was visiting her, and she said that she was going to go to another state to visit her sister for the holidays. And she said, you know, when I get off the plane, my sister's going to look at me and say, you've put on some weight. And as my friend is telling me this story, she's getting... tighter, could we say? How about angry? Yeah? It's like, I'm going to get off the plane and my sister's going to criticize me for gaining weight and accuse me of eating a lot and tell me I look awful. And, you know, she's getting really revved up about this. Yeah. Her sister isn't anywhere around. She hasn't even gotten on the plane to go see her sister yet, but she's mad. Okay, because she knows what's going to happen. Okay, good situation to not believe everything we think, isn't it? Yeah? Just, you know, we're dreaming up some big story and getting ourselves upset about it. Yeah? Much better, yeah, take a step back, calm the mind down, see what reality is. Yeah, at least conventional reality. Yeah. And then go on, instead of getting ourselves so, you know, worked up about things. So I would say, usually, once a day at least, we get ourselves worked up about something. Would you say that?
At least.
Yeah, at least, yeah. And whatever our problem is that day, it might be a problem with a colleague or a family member or who knows what, but our problem of the day is always really awful, isn't it? And very serious. And worthwhile doing an entire meditation session about. Om mani padme hum, mani padme hum, mani padme hum. My brother called me yesterday, Om mani padme hum. And he was so rude to me on the phone, Om mani padme hum. And it's always like this. I mean, I'm an older sister and he treats me so disrespectfully, Om mani padme hum. You know? And this goes on for an entire session, and then you hear, and you come out of wherever you were, you know, whatever trance state you were in, living in la-la land, planning your revenge against your brother. Yeah. It's amazing. Have you ever done that? Entire meditation session. And we think we can't concentrate. No? So, yeah, these are all situations in which it's good for us not to believe what we think, because we're getting ourselves worked up over an imaginary situation. So, that's what he talks about in this book.
Yeah.
So I thought that I would just kind of pick out some of the stories in the book, because what it is there's a description about each verse, and then after the verse, there's one or more stories, real stories, that people told me about how they applied the meaning of that verse to their own life. And so it's really interesting, because people sent me stories, or just we were hanging around the kitchen table and, you know, we came out with the stories. Okay. So, and also people last night were interested in the prison work I do. So there's some stories in here from inmates. So I thought I would read the a few stories and some verses. Okay. So I'll read you the verse that starts out here. Okay. All suffering comes from the wish for your own happiness. Perfect Buddhas are born from the thought to help others. Therefore, exchange your own happiness for the suffering of others. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay, so we're in a suffering situation and we're thinking it's the other person's fault. And Togmeb Zampo says all suffering comes from the wish for your own happiness. In other words, from our own self-centeredness, like we talked about last night. We don't really like to hear that. Because, you know, there's something so nice when you can blame somebody else for your problems. There's something so nice. It means we don't have any responsibility. It means we can relax and be a victim. Yeah? You know, nobody else makes us into a victim by harming us. We make ourselves a victim by how we think. Yeah. So, somebody's harming me. I'm sweet innocent. I'm a victim of this rude person who deliberately wants to harm me because they are either bipolar or, you know, manic, depressive, or, you know,
they have some psychological disorder that I am diagnosing, even though I'm not a psychiatrist, doesn't matter, I can still diagnose them, you know? And so they're doing this to me, yeah. And he, you know, Tomie Zambo has the gall to tell me that my suffering is coming from the wish for my own happiness. Yeah. What he's meaning here is our selfish wish for our own happiness. Just wishing for happiness, there's nothing wrong with. We all want that. But our selfish wish for our own happiness. Okay? Whereas Buddhas, the enlightened beings who experience bliss all the time, he says, perfect Buddhas are born from the thought to help others. So thinking about our own happiness in a selfish way brings us suffering. Yeah. Thinking about others' suffering and wanting to help them is the cause for Buddhahood, where we experience joy. It's the opposite of what we usually think. And so he says, therefore, exchange your own happiness for the suffering of others. So when we're grasping in a stingy way about our own happiness, instead, give our happiness away and voluntarily take on the suffering of others. So this actually leads us into the taking and giving meditation, the Tonglen meditation. Some of you may be familiar with that, where you imagine others who are suffering, you imagine taking their suffering with compassion, and then you imagine giving your body, possessions, and virtue to others with love, and them receiving it and being content and free of their misery. So this is what he's telling us to do. Yeah. Usually when we're suffering, like I said, we play up the victim angle. Yeah. I'm a victim of what somebody else did. That means that you should feel sorry for me, and that means you should fix my problem. Yeah. And until that, I'm just going to be a miserable victim. Yeah. Until I get the attention that I want and the world, you know, does something good for me. Where is that attitude going to get us? Yeah? Do you have that attitude? And if so, what are you thinking you're going to get out of it? Yeah. I know because I have this attitude. You know? Anybody else have that? Yeah? No, just me. Okay. But, you know, it's like, oh, what am I expecting out of this? Yeah. Really, that the world knows that I'm miserable and that I'm the most important thing in it. So the world should change and fix my problems. So I should be happy. And until the world does that, I have every right to sit here and sniffle and feel sorry for myself and be angry at the world. I don't have to do anything else but that. And where does that get us? You know, we use a lot of tissues. And that's about it. It doesn't get us anywhere, does it? It doesn't get us anywhere. Because other people do not play along with our trip. Or maybe they try to. We're sitting there, you know, in our victim mentality. And somebody comes up and says, you look unhappy. Is something the matter? And we go, no! And turn away from them. Yeah. It's really rather foolish on our part. So Tomie Zambo said, you know, instead of doing that to ourselves, yeah,
do this other meditation wherein we imagine taking on others' suffering and giving them our happiness. And that completely transforms our own mind. And it also eliminates fear. Yeah? Because when we're afraid, we're looking at the other person as some kind of objective, threatening entity. Yeah. When we do this meditation, we see that that person is actually miserable. They're suffering. That's why they're doing what causes fear in us. If we tune into their suffering, we can have compassion for them, not fear. So that's what the story I'm going to read illustrates. So this story was written by somebody that I met when I lived in Missouri, and I've done prison work for a long time. And I went into to give some talks in a prison in Missouri. It was 2002, 14 years ago. And so I've known him for that long. We've been in touch since then. He's quite an amazing person, extremely intelligent. He set up an internal TV channel in the prison where he is, for educational programs and entertainment for the other inmates. Anyway, here's the story he wrote that pertains to that verse. He says, of all the practices I've done, the taking and giving meditation has had the most profound effects in my life. In particular, one of the emotions I have the most trouble with is fear. Okay, if you've ever been in a prison, fear is a constant companion, because prisons are quite dangerous, at least the ones in the U.S. I've lived my whole life in one kind of... A lot of it is conditioned fear. I've lived my whole life in one kind of dangerous situation or another. Fear is one of those emotions that can quickly move me from acting wisely to acting irrationally. The meditation of taking suffering motivated by compassion and giving happiness motivated by love has helped me more than anything else in situations where I feel intense fear. I am imprisoned for life without parole due to a murder I committed when I was 16. The following story occurred in prison. Joe, another inmate who was a friend of mine, was being sexually exploited. One day we were walking in the yard discussing how he could put a stop to this distressing situation. As we walked and talked, he finally came to a point where he was just going to tell the guy who was exploiting him that he had had enough and then walk off. Of course, if you have dealt with prisons long enough, you know that such a confrontation usually doesn't end well. As we were walking, Joe's friend, the guy who's exploiting him, came out to holler at him. Joe did just what he said he was going to do. His friend quickly figured out that I was at fault for Joe's sudden courage, and now his friend wanted to holler at me. And I knew what that meant, and it wasn't good. Okay, so a big fight is brewing here. I did my best not to respond with my first reaction, which was to strike first. Instead, while I walked towards the guy, I practiced taking and giving. Taking from him his desire and greed, giving him what little virtue I had created in my Dharma practice. While doing this, I recited the Tara mantra, Om Tare Tutare Ture Soha. By the time I got over to the guy, I was calmed. not feeling fight or flight. Of course, the exchange between us was heated. He threatened me in various ways and wanted me to pay him money for taking his boy. Yeah. Joe went in and told the officer that his friend was out of bounds. The guy went to the hole, meaning disciplinary segregation, and was eventually transferred. During the incident, I didn't have to resort to violence because I never even felt moved to that level of fear beyond the initial feeling that led me to practice taking and giving. In short, taking and giving helped me to react from a more spacious place, a place where I had options other than confrontation and aggression. In the end, it worked out well. Joe isn't getting exploited anymore, and the guy was transferred. Now Joe is in a much safer camp, working on the inner issues that led him to that situation. He was abused as a child and quickly identified himself in the victim role. So quite a story, isn't it, of averting a major dangerous situation by changing the way you look at it. Yeah, tuning into the other guy's suffering, imagine taking that, giving him your happiness, and so not needing to put on an aggressive bully front in order, you know, as a response to the situation. Okay. Want to hear another prison story? Yeah. In the TuptonChudra.org website, the prison section is one of the most popular ones. We have writings from various inmates on it. You know, I was surprised too, but it gets a lot of clicks. Okay, so this is a story from a man who came to the Abbey, to one of our retreats, and he went in to do some volunteer work in a prison. So this, he gave me this story. So he says, a while ago, I was asked to fill in for the full-time instructor to teach vocational sheet metal to inmates at a prison. I was fortunate to have had dedicated teachers instill a little good sense in me, so that when I arrived to start the 6-week assignment, I was able to discern that the men were more proficient in sheet metal fabrication than I was. I also knew I was not very smart about prison life. To take charge, I proposed we work on something that would benefit all of them. Okay. Now, why do you think that they were more proficient in sheet metal fabrication?
To escape.
Yeah. After some discussion, they suggested we go to the prison dump and scavenge for something. We found an old tool chest that was in bad condition, which we hauled back to class to refurbish. I pitched in working with the men. During the course of the work, our conversation consisted mostly of me hearing their stories. I gradually grew to understand that a single rash action had them behind bars while I went home each night. After I'd been there a few weeks, a violent gang-related multiple stabbing murder occurred in the exercise yard. This is why prison is dangerous. I was upset and wanted to know more about the murder, so I asked the guys what had happened. A gang member told me in some detail about the weapon and what had occurred. Other inmates joined in and gave me more information. This information, based on based on common trust between the prisoners and me, was a potential bombshell, and I knew that I could not betray their trust, so I kept their disclosure to myself. Yeah, because they were really trusting him, telling him the details of the murder, because he could have easily gone to the warden or some officer and spilled the beans, gotten a lot of people in trouble, and then of course they probably would have taken their revenge on him. But he realized that they were trusting him a lot. It's really quite extraordinary that they trusted a volunteer this much. So he kept quiet about it. When I finished the assignment, the men approached me and told me that I was a nice guy, but something of a fool. They showed me a knife and told me they could have killed me at any time. After saying this, they cut the knife into small pieces and discarded them. They then surprised me by saying that they had no need for the tool chest and that it was a gift for me. But the biggest gift they gave me was the knowledge that if we can remain trusting and non-judgmental, compassion will come from both sides. The biggest bars most of us contend with are those we construct around ourselves. Yeah, so he handled his fear by having trust and kindness and compassion, which these guys repaid, some of them gang members who had a knife and could have killed him, but decided to trust him in return. Okay, here's another one. So this is another one of the verses where Tomei Zampo is giving us a situation that we encounter and then telling us to do the opposite of what we feel like doing in that situation. Okay, so the verse reads, if someone tries to cut off your head when you haven't done the slightest thing wrong, a little bit of an extreme situation. Out of compassion, take all her misdeeds upon yourself. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay, so here we are in a situation where somebody is trying to really harm us physically or maybe ruin our reputation or do something really disastrous for us. Okay, I cut off our head. And we haven't done the slightest thing wrong. You have ever had that happen? Somebody getting really furious at you and you can't figure out why they're so mad? You had that happen? Yeah. So that kind of situation. Then, instead of, you know, how would we usually react in that situation? Somebody's trying to harm us. We haven't done anything wrong. We have no clue why they're acting that way. What do we usually do? Yeah, we defend ourselves, we attack first, we back away from the situation and, you know, don't talk to the other person again. We retaliate, maybe we spread bad, you know, bad rumors about them. Of course, we don't spread bad rumors, these are things we know are true. Yeah. We talk to other people so that everybody else is on our side. Against that person. Yeah, don't we? Yeah, this is the kind of way we react. So what's he telling us to do instead? Out of compassion, take all her misdeeds upon yourself. And we're going, huh? Here's a person who's trying to cut off my head when I haven't done anything wrong. And you're telling me first not to retaliate, and second, to take all of their misdeeds, all of that person's negative karma that's going to afflict them with suffering for a long time in the future, take all of that upon myself when I haven't done anything wrong and I didn't start it? It's like, come on, Togme Zamba, what are you talking about? Isn't that how we would first react to this? Yeah. Like, this guy's got to be joking. Yeah. I need to defend myself. Okay, so why is he saying, out of compassion, take all her misdeeds upon yourself? Yeah. So this is another example of the taking and giving meditation. You know, to see, here's this person who is trying to harm us. Why are they trying to harm us, especially if we haven't done anything wrong? Is this person who's doing this action a happy individual? No, they're not a happy individual. Happy people don't go around hurting others. They don't wake up in the morning and say, it's springtime in Denmark, and for a change it isn't raining. And I feel so happy because I get to go look at the daffodils, and I think I'm going to go punch somebody in the nose. Yeah? I mean, people who are happy don't want to go harm others. Why do people harm others? Because they're unhappy. When people try and harm us, do we think that that person's unhappy? Or do we just think they're evil? Usually we think they're evil. We don't think there's an unhappy person. Yeah. So he's telling us to tune in to the other person, look in their heart. What's really going on inside of them? They're miserable. Yeah. And so with this taking and giving a meditation, let's imagine taking their suffering upon ourselves and giving them happiness. Yeah. And happiness here doesn't mean that they can go and chop off somebody's head and not get arrested. It doesn't mean that we're not wishing them the happiness of getting what they think they want. Because often what people think they want is not good for them and actually causes them misery. Okay. So what we're doing is we're trying to take on their suffering and give them a happy, internal happiness. Yeah. So that they're response to the world isn't one of resentment and belligerence and so on. Okay, so when we wish people happiness, we have to be very astute about doing so. It doesn't mean that we give them what they think will satisfy their need. You know, it means we really give them internal happiness or peace of mind. Okay? So out of compassion, take all their misdeeds upon yourself. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Quite a practice, isn't it? Yeah? Okay, so here's another story from an inmate. Not all the stories in the book are from inmates. I just picked out a few that were. Okay, so he's saying, I'm incarcerated, and today was feeling rather strong aversion to a certain officer. Okay. Now it happens when you're incarcerated that the officers, I mean, nobody wants to grow up to be an officer in a prison. Yeah, you never hear little kids saying, I want to be a prison officer when I grow up, you know? So first of all, it's somebody who, you know, they took that job because they needed to. It wasn't their first choice. And they have a very unpleasant job. They have to handcuff people, walk people here and there. They're working with people who are dangerous. And a lot of the officers themselves have a lot of anger and aggression. And so sometimes they are not so nice to the inmates. And so you can easily get a situation where an officer is making things very difficult for a particular inmate. Yeah. So this inmate was feeling the aversion to a particular officer, probably for something like that. Because sometimes the officers are not very respectful to the guys who are imprisoned. So he goes on. He says, "We had a horrible storm. It was raining and the wind gusts were up to 50 miles per hour." Gee, it sounds like here. "I had to go outside to turn in my college books," because he was taking a college course, "which left me out in the rain at 8:45 a.m. The next regular unlock, the time when we can move about and I could go outside, wasn't until 10 a.m., so an hour and 15 minutes. I asked the, and so it's storming and the wind's blowing. Yeah? So I asked the building control officer to let me in according to my a pass, because he had to return these college textbooks. Yeah, so he's out in the yard trying to get into the building to return the college textbook. You know, he's out in the rain at 8:45. The next actual movement time when the prisoners are allowed to go places isn't until 10 o'clock. He asks the officer if he can go into the building anyway and get out of the rain. So the officer came to the window and asked what kind of pass. When I told him it was for turning in my books, he said, "Come back at 10 a.m. which meant I would be out in the rain and wind for over an hour. Yeah. The officer could have let him in, no problem. Over the course of an hour, many inmates went in and out with the officer. Clearly, he was letting in and out only those who he wanted to. At one point, he even let out and back in my own cellmate. He made sure to only let him in, although he only had to press the same buttons to let both of us in." So the officer is being deliberately mean. "So I stood out there feeling the rain soaking through my many layers of clothes. I tried to maintain peace of mind. I thought about all the animals who had no warm clothing, blankets, or cups of coffee. As I felt the wind against my wet face, I told myself it wasn't personal. The officer's response said more about the officer than about me. The experience was a reminder that at times I had refused someone else's comfort. At 9:50 a.m., the power went out, and he had to let the 8 to 10 people who weren't worthy, who were standing out in the rain, back in. That's how I felt, unworthy of a little compassion. Now at 4:50 in the afternoon, as my clothes are hanging on makeshift hooks and are still wet, I consider missing dinner to avoid wearing those wet clothes back out into the rain. Truthfully, I'm still not feeling equanimity, but at the same time, I realize a few things. One, it isn't bringing me peace to hold on to my anger. Two, I'm pretty sure that officer isn't thinking about me out in the rain. And three, It does no good for anyone to fight dependent arising and emptiness. While this letter hasn't been helpful in terms of explaining equanimity, it is helping me to see how hooked I am by this morning's events. Why do we hold on to our labels of friend, enemy, and stranger? Does holding on to the officer as an enemy perpetrate behavior on his part towards me? Does it predispose me to expect negative responses in the future? This touches on the need to go beyond hope and fear and to just let each moment be as it is. And yet, I suppose what I feel is attachment to a victim stance. Poor me. But wait, I have the Buddha nature, so maybe what I really have is a mistaken identity. Then I realize it is all conceptual stuff that keeps me attached to the past. I breathe in, breathe out, and let it all go. Okay? So these are our stories about how people really use the Dharma to see their situation from a different perspective. And in that way, the emotion they felt before, they no longer feel. It's gone. Okay? So it's not repressing emotions. Yeah, it's looking at the situation in a different way so that that emotion has no story behind it to stand on. Because so many of our emotions, the way the emotion develops, is we get some raw sense data. The ignorant mind grasps onto ourself as some independent, existent person. Yeah. Thinks that whatever the other person said or did is some kind of inherently existent action. Adds on a whole story, including our psychological diagnosis, our imputed motivation, yeah, that's all based on a lot of our habitual stories that we've been telling ourselves for years. And then, after all of that, we get upset, or whatever emotion it is comes, okay? So there's all this stuff that comes before the emotion, and that emotion isn't the only thing we can possibly feel in this situation. We're feeling that situation because of the self-grasping ignorance, because of the inappropriate attention that created this story that isn't true. And then the emotion comes. If we go back, I mean, the best thing to do is to get rid of the ignorance by seeing the ultimate nature of reality. But that's a little difficult. At the time being, we have to build up to that. So in the meantime, what do? Is we start to look at the story that we wrote about the situation and take that apart and see how false it is. And use another, you know, practice one of the thought training techniques, which helps us to describe the situation to ourselves in a different way. And then the emotion changes. Okay? So instead of feeling, you know, when we're in a very emotional state or something happened that we don't like, that our emotion is the only possible response that any sane person would feel, instead of thinking like that, yeah, go back and shed the story and look at the situation in another way. And then we see that there's actually a whole variety of emotions we could experience
that are much more realistic. And if we're very skillful, we could even take the whole situation and turn it into the path to awakening by generating a virtuous mental state ourselves. So this is why it's not always so good to believe what we think. Yeah? I'll give you another thing that I use for criticism, yeah, that I find quite helpful. Because as I mentioned last night, I don't like to be criticized. I don't think anybody likes to be criticized. Yeah. But especially me. So this thing is, because usually, you know, when we're criticized, then we get angry, we want to retaliate, we want to defend ourselves. We want to explain to the other person how what they're saying is wrong. Flat out wrong, and they have no business talking to us that way at all. Okay? Because we want to establish our power over them. They're challenging us by criticizing us. Okay? So this, what this technique involves is, you know, somebody says something to you that is clearly criticism. So instead of reacting to their tone of voice or the volume of their voice, okay, or the wording that they used, we just look at what is the point that they're telling us. Yeah? And then we ask ourselves, is what they're telling me about myself, is it true? Okay, did I do that thing that they're criticizing me for? Or do I have that trait that they're criticizing me for? If I have that trait, if I did that action, then there's no need to get mad at the other person because what they're saying is true. I did it. I need to own it. I need to apologize or whatever it is, you know, clarify the situation. And there's no reason for me to get angry because what he said is true. And it would be, if I got angry, it would be like somebody saying, you have a nose on your face, and then getting angry about that. You know, the guy's telling the truth. I have a nose on my face. In my case, it's rather a big one. What am I going to do? Say, no, sorry, I don't have a nose. You know, you're wrong. No, I did that. I have that trait. Or I made that mistake, I own it. Repair the situation, go on. Anger is not at all necessary in response to that criticism. Now, what happens if the person is accusing me of something I didn't do? Something false, okay, that I didn't do. Again, no reason to get angry. Because what the guy's saying is wrong. He has wrong information. If I sit down and talk to him and give him correct information, the situation will get cleared up. I don't need to be angry. So in that case, it's like him telling me I have horns on my head. You know? I do a little checking. No horns. You know? He has some wrong information. I can go and explain. The problem solved. No need to get angry. What do you think about that? It makes some sense for not getting angry when you're criticized? Because there's two situations. If what he said is true, no need to get angry. If what he said isn't true, no need to get angry. Yeah.
I think sometimes we put up a psychological defense saying,
okay, maybe he, she is right, but at least he, she could say it in a nice way.
Yeah. It's like, if you're going to criticize me, please say please before. And please bring me some chocolate cake as well. You know, I mean, at least be polite when you criticize me. You know, we have a whole checklist that they should fulfill before they give us any feedback that we don't want to hear. Right? When is that going to happen? No time soon. But it's an interesting thought, isn't it? About, you know, what use is it getting angry when we've been criticized? Doesn't make any sense at all. I remember one time I was at teachings with my teacher, and my teacher, you know, the teachings are scheduled for 7 o'clock in the evening. He starts maybe 9 o'clock and ends at maybe 2 o'clock, and I'm a morning person. Yeah? So it was one of those situations. We're finally leaving the hall at 2 o'clock. There's another nun who got on my case about something. No, it wasn't a nun, it was a laywoman. And she got on my case because the flowers on the altar, you know, hadn't been changed. And it's the nun's job to change the flowers on the altar. And these flowers did not look good and were not good enough for our teacher. And, you know, I was a nun, so therefore it was my fault. Okay, I knew nothing about this. Yeah, and so initially I was starting to get kind of riled up because I'm getting blamed for something that wasn't my responsibility, and the flowers look fine. They weren't wilted, they looked fine, you know. But it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I said to myself, if I get angry, I'm wasting precious minutes of sleep. And it's not worthwhile to get angry at this time. And then, you know, so I went up to the cabin, I fell asleep. And then I thought about it the next day, and I thought, you know, wherever I go, there's going to be people who criticize me. And there's going to be people who blame me for things I didn't do. This is a very common feature, a very common event in the world. I'm not the only one it happens to, and this isn't the only time it's going to happen to me. And where am I going to go in this entire universe where nobody is going to criticize me? Yeah, where am I going to go? And so I had one of these little talks with myself, and I just said, you know, I have to drop this because it's not worth wasting my time on. And I just have to recognize I'm going to get criticized, I'm going to get blamed, and so be it. This is the nature of cyclic existence. And if I don't like cyclic existence, then I should practice harder and get out. Instead of being so lazy in my practice and blaming the world. So you see, there's all these ways we can use to change how we look at the situation. And when we do so, then our whole mood, our whole emotion changes. Yeah. The Buddha was so skillful in how he described different situations to us and how to act. Okay, so we have some time for a few questions, comments? Yeah?
I like in Burma was saying that sometimes he had to get angry with the student out of compassion, mm-hmm. because that student needed the anger.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes it happens that somebody may act in a forceful way out of compassion without anger.
Okay.
Yeah. I think parents do that sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, parents, do you sometimes do that? Yeah. If your little child has run into the middle of the highway, your little three-year-old is starting to walk in the middle of the highway, do you walk and pick up your three-year-old and go, "Oh, you know, Susie dear, it's dangerous in the highway. Let's not go play there." No, you don't do that. You pick up your child and you look and you say, "Do not go in the highway." Because you need to make a forceful impression on this child not to do that behavior. Yeah? Are you angry? You have compassion for that child. You're trying to protect your child. Okay? So in the same way, it happens sometimes that teachers need to speak in a very forceful way or do something, you know, to get the student to wake up. Yeah, to get the point across. But they're not angry. And if they are angry, then they need to go back to the cushion and calm themselves down first. There are questions? Or
yes.
Yeah.
We have a teacher, an Indian teacher in this town, Mr. Hawk. Mm-hmm. He always tells us it doesn't matter what other people think about you. Mm-hmm. But most people try not to be excluded.
To try not to be...
To be excluded.
Excluded, yeah.
Yes. So we all think to do what others expect from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that being angry is also a power to change the world, isn't it? It's not just a bad emotion. It's also power, in a way.
Some people see anger as power.
Yeah.
I actually see anger as weakness. Because when we're angry, we aren't thinking very clearly, and our actions are not well thought out. At least that's my experience. What's your experience when you're angry? Do you sometimes say and do things to the people you love the most when you're angry? You know, say and do harmful, cruel, mean things to them because you're angry, whereas you would never treat a stranger that way? Yeah. Because anger clouds our mind. We can't think clearly. So I see anger as weakness, not as power. Yeah. And I think in situations where we talked about this yesterday, where there's harm going on, compassion for both sides, the perpetrator and the recipient of the harm, compassion for both people is actually more appropriate and more effective for finding some kind of solution that may meet the needs of both people in some way. Anger has power, but it doesn't make you powerful in a good way. It makes you confused.
Well, sometimes I can use anger, if it doesn't get too much, as just a sign that something has to change.
Mm-hmm.
And then having to calm down again to see, so what can change? Is it either the environment or is it me?
Mm-hmm.
But just to use it as really a signal that there's something that isn't right.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting because one time I was giving a talk at a university to some professors from the conflict resolution mediation department, and I was speaking about the problems with anger, and they said the same thing, that anger can indicate to us that something is amiss and we need to correct it. They also got very angry at me for saying that I thought anger was an afflictive emotion and unrealistic. Yeah. I thought that was interesting. People who were trying to encourage conflict resolution and communication got angry at me for proposing that anger wasn't a suitable mechanism. But they said that same thing. It lets you know something's wrong. Yeah. My question is that the only emotion that can let you know that something is wrong?
No.
No. There's a lot of other things that can let you know something's wrong. Yeah? So seeing the danger in anger, if there's another emotion or another way we can notice injustice or that something's wrong, why don't we use that?
Yeah. And often it's sadness underneath that. Mm-hmm. And then I go deeper and there are different stories coming up. And
yeah. Often beneath the anger, you might find sadness.
Fear.
You might find fear. And you might find attachment and expectations. Yeah. Or you might find hurt, which is also related to attachment and expectations. Yeah. So it can be quite interesting to really examine the anger and see what is really going on. And I find personally when I'm angry that I usually have quite unrealistic expectations. I expect a sentient being to be perfect, the definition of perfect being doing what I want them to do. And they don't comply. Yeah, they have their own minds, their own way of thinking, their own predispositions from the past. Yeah, they're not going to fulfill my expectations. Why do I think they should? Because I'm foolish. That's why. Yeah, I need to get rid of my foolishness.
It's a tough job.
Hmm? It's a tough job. It is. Yeah. But you have a choice. Either get rid of your foolishness or be chronically miserable. There's not a third choice in there. Yeah. So between those two choices, which one is going to be easier?
Don't ask me that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think it's quite common in our society to suppress the anger, especially here in Denmark. I think we're quite good at that, keeping it down. And in my experience, that's a quite big obstacle because as long as you suppress it and you don't kind of allow yourself to acknowledge that you are angry, mm-hmm. you'll never notice what is beneath the anger, as we just talked about.
Yeah.
So how to deal with that in a skillful way in the Buddhist practice?
Yeah, so there's a lot of societal pressure not to be angry from certain societies or towards certain people. And so as a result of this unspoken message that you're not supposed to be angry, then we stuff the anger. Of course, the anger's still there. And it comes out in all sorts of other not so nice ways. Okay? And so that's why what the Buddha is doing is proposing that we look at the situation from a different perspective so that the anger doesn't arise. we find that there's no reason to be angry. Because whenever we get angry, we always have a reason behind it, you know. And the reason is they did this and this, and that isn't fair, and whatever our preconceptions are. Yeah, we make a story that justifies our anger. When we have to look at that story and ask ourselves, are my reasons actually true? Or is this story I'm telling myself about how awful the other person is true? Then we see that we have an exaggerated, mistaken state of mind. When we see that our state of mind is mistaken, that the story isn't true, the situation doesn't exist as we think it does, then there's no reason to get angry. Yeah, because we've gotten rid of the reason or the story that we've been using to justify our anger. Okay, so then we don't have anything to suppress anymore. But we have to really work at this. Yeah, it isn't like you come and hear one talk, yeah, and then next time you get angry, you scratch your head and say, what did she say I was supposed to think? And then go, oh yeah, she said something about your story, and is it true? But in the meantime, you know, you've already said and done who knows what. Okay, so this is the advantage of having a regular daily meditation practice, is we learn these methods either by reading the book or coming to Dharma class. And then in our meditation, we pull out situations from our own life and we practice thinking in these different ways. We practice questioning ourselves in these different ways and seeing if we can turn around some of those situations that we've already experienced and let go of whatever anger and resentment we've been holding on to. So this involves a lot of practice beforehand. Okay? It's kind of like when you go to take your driver's test, you know? You gotta practice driving a long time before you go take your driver's test. Because if you don't practice, you're gonna get in a wreck, and they're certainly not gonna give you a license. Yeah? So it's the same thing. We need to really learn these methods and practice them repetitively so that we become familiar with them. And then they change our whole viewpoint, and we can also tap into them much more quickly when we need to.
I just think that those methods, they aren't that effective for me before I come to take the step of acknowledging the anger. And that means when suppressing the anger, I kind of reject the part of myself.
Yeah.
And as long as I do that, I find those methods very, very hard to use.
Right, you have to acknowledge the anger first.
To take it in, somehow allow it in myself.
Yeah.
And that's the step.
I see. So you're asking about how to acknowledge the anger.
Yeah, in the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah, or how to maybe even identify the anger. Do you have problems identifying when you're angry?
Not so much anymore.
Yeah? Okay. Well, some people have problem identifying when they're angry. So let me just, even though that may not be yours, let me give it for the people who's his. Yeah, so if you're one of those people who, you know, you have a hard time identifying your anger, check in with your body and see what's happening in your body. Yeah, because often when we're just starting to get angry, we're getting certain sensations in our body. Yeah. What kind of sensations do you get when you're getting angry? What's happening?
Heartbeat.
Yeah, your heartbeat. Goes faster, doesn't it? Yeah? What else? Your stomach gets tight. Yeah? What else?
The breathing gets quicker.
Yeah. breathing gets quicker. It's not slow, relaxed breathing. It's tighter.
Muscle tense.
Mm. Yeah. Our jaw gets tense, our muscles get tense.
If you look yourself in the mirror, it's not very nice.
It's true. It's true. When we look in the mirror when we're angry, we are not very attractive. That's why they say that anger creates the karmic cause to be unattractive in a future life. Yeah. For that reason. Okay. So, yeah?
Yeah, now your body is getting warmer.
Yeah, your body's warmer. Some people get cold palms, some people get hot, sweaty palms. Yeah? Face gets flushed, you're really angry by that time, okay? But the thing is to really learn to check in with your body and notice some of these signals when they're still very small so that you can see the anger when it's very small. Or some people find it easier to look at what I call the flavor of your mind, the mental feeling in your mind. Because I know before, when I'm starting to get angry, there's a shift just in the quality of the feeling in my mind. I can't describe it in words, but there's some kind of uncomfortable mental feeling. And for me, that's a signal that, okay, I'm starting to get angry, I need to stop and look at the situation, okay? So once we notice we're getting angry, then we just say, I'm getting angry. It's the truth, it's the reality. We don't need to say, I shouldn't get angry, I'm not supposed to get angry, what a bad person I am for getting angry, what would people think of me if they knew I was angry. We don't need to go into all that self-judgment. We just need to recognize I'm in the process of getting angry. It's just a statement of fact. That's it. Yeah. Then the thing is, okay, I'm in the process. Anger's small. It's going to get bigger if I keep on. Do I want to let my anger continue to get bigger? Or do I want to apply some method from the Dharma now to start to counteract the anger by seeing the situation in a different way? Yeah? So when we're doing this, we may notice, okay, I'm getting angry, and then we go, what the heck, I'm getting hangry, you know, and we just go and act it out. After a while, we get kind of fed up because getting angry doesn't really bring about what we want. So we start to say to ourselves, you know, okay, I'm starting to get angry. I really need to check into what is going on in my mind right now.
Can I ask you, does meditation make us less angry? I mean, we have this Gonda's body center. Mm-hmm. Some years ago, I feel like people were a little bit angry mm-hmm. at the center. And I asked my friend, what's going on here? And he said, it's because they meditate so much. You know, we have some scientists, some experiment in the Middle East. And if there are many people meditating, it's more peaceful, for instance, in Israel.
Yeah.
Is that true? What does meditation
do? Okay. Let me just finish with this question and then come back to yours. Okay, so is that making some sense, you know, to just acknowledge without any self-judgment and then say, do I want to continue being angry or do I want to stop the anger? I want to stop the anger. Okay, then what do I need to do? And then if we become familiar with one of these, practices before, then we call it to mind. And it's going to work better when the anger is small. Once the anger is big, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to learn how to catch it when it's small.
Does that make some sense? Yeah, that helps. Okay. Now, if people are meditating and getting angrier, I would say that they're not meditating correctly. Okay? That may, it could be that they're forcing a technique on themselves but not really taking it in. Yeah? It could be that a lot of things are coming up from the past for them that they still need to process. Maybe they're not, maybe it's not exactly that they're meditating incorrectly, but things from the past are coming up and they need to process those things. You know, because that definitely happens when you do some serious meditation. Yeah. And as to, you know, do societies get more peaceful when people meditate? I think so. Yeah. I mean, families get more peaceful. There's one person that was coming to some classes I was giving, and he said that, you know, first of all, his family loves when he goes on retreat because when he comes back, he's always so relaxed and he's happy. So his son told me, I know to ask Dad the hard things after retreat. Yeah. But then sometimes the kids, you know, like mom and dad's getting mad, and the kids, I've heard of kids who will say, you know, mom, dad, you need to go meditate right now. Yeah, because it impacts the people around us. Yeah. It doesn't mean that all the time we're going to arise from a meditation session feeling nice and refreshed and peaceful. Don't expect that from your meditation sessions. But sometimes what comes up is a lot of garbage. Yeah. But actually, when you have garbage arise in your meditation, it's good because you can't clean the garbage if you can't see it. So now it's becoming obvious. Now we can start to do something about it. We may not be able to completely resolve it in one session. It may take a period of time, but by at least seeing it and acknowledging it, we're taking the first steps in resolving it. Okay, so let's have our short digestion meditation, where you think about something you heard and apply it to your own life. Yeah, in such a way that you can remember it and take it home with you and continue to think about it.
let's rejoice that you're able to spend the evening thinking about something that was really useful and beneficial. So feel good about what you've done. And rejoice also at what everybody in the room has done this evening, all the good energy we've created together. And rejoice also at all the goodness in the world. And then imagine all of that merit or positive potential, whatever you want to call it, goodness, as a light in the center of your chest, and send it out into the universe so that it touches all the living beings. Don't just send it to friends and relatives, send it to everybody. And imagine that it gives them incredible mental clarity, compassion, kind heart, and wisdom. It's been very wonderful being here with you these two nights. So please keep up your Dharma practice. Yeah, you're very fortunate to have met the Dharma. You're fortunate to have a lovely center and the friendship of all the people here together with you. So really take advantage of your situation and your circumstance and learn as much as you can. Reflect on it, put it into practice, meditate on it in your life, and have a long-term view. Don't expect quick results, but be content just to do your practice, and in that way, you know, you accumulate the causes for goodness, and the result in goodness comes.